The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brooke Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
Now it's True Wealth, presented by Little John Financial Services. Here is David Littlejohn with True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, we're going to go ahead and try this again since I jumped the gun a little bit. This is Justin Bruggeman, and you're on True Wealth, and I'm here with
Matt Dixon.
Hey, we apologize. We were running a little late. David's running a little late, and me and Matt got stopped by the train on the way here.
You can't move a train, right? Like, what can you do?
I'm like 90th percentile if I ever go across Garden Valley, I hit that thing. It's like amazing. So welcome. You know, what is it David says? It's the best Tuesday you've had all week.
That's right. Man, you have been listening to the radio show, Justin.
Are
you sneaking it? At home, you've got it tuned in?
I do, and I do listen to the podcast too if I don't catch up on it.
There you go. Well, Justin, what do we got going on today? What are we talking about?
You know,
how are we starting the show? You know David's going to show up at some point today, hijack everything, derail what we've got going on. But what's the general outline today?
That's where, me and Matt decided we were going to think of a topic. And then we were talking to David and he said, that's boring.
But it's pertinent, it's relevant, and everyone can hear it, right? It applies to everyone. Yeah.
Very true. But... I gave David a quick call on the way here, and I was like, what exactly do you mean? Because the text message he got, or sent us, made absolutely zero sense to me.
Yeah, what did he text us again?
And what was it? Flow versus quant versus fundamental. And as he walks in here...
Did you figure out how to use the actual board?
I did, barely.
All the buttons are pushed, right?
Yes.
Okay, well, take it away.
No, so now...
I've been on a plane all day.
So well-rested.
Yeah, totally well-rested.
Or is it well-rested and jet lag, like, mixed into one?
You know, I got the most sleep in the last week, last night, and I think it was 5 hours.
Oh.
So I'm just... Yes, I'm feeling super well-rested and maybe mildly wired.
Ah.
So explain to us what the text message, which I got a little bit of what you said, but it was a very short message and like, this is what we should talk about. And we're like, I don't know.
I got nothing, right? No, so here's what happens. I was in Tennessee and then I went to Texas. And I've got some folks that I have been working with in Texas that are in the sort of the financial research field now. For more than a decade. Okay. So they're friends of mine, but we talk a lot of shop. So yesterday, we spent most of the day talking about what was going on in the marketplace. And it was precipitated by looking at oil prices.
Okay.
Right. So oil prices have really gone up. And the conversation started with one of these comments that happens in every household, right? I'd be like, just you wake up, you're cooking coffee, and you look to your significant other and you say, look at that. There's a margin call in Switzerland, right? I mean, like everybody says that, right? And what that really means is that I'm pretty sure it was Switzerland, but it was for companies that were in the oil space that had been borrowing money. They had to essentially produce money to cover it because their collateral was no longer appropriately valued. And it creates a shift in the supply and demand balance in the marketplace. So just think about it. We talk about this all the time, right? There's only two things that control the price of anything, right?
Right.
Supply and demand. A margin call, if you're borrowing money to buy a position, or in this case, to sell a position before you own it, okay? And then you have a margin call because the prices are going against the position that you took. So, I'm losing money on this deal and my collateral is shrinking. So margin call means I need to come up with more money. Then it changes things, especially if you've, for example, had a short position and everything was going up. Now, keep everybody on the show, right? If you listen long enough, a short position means you sold it before you owned it.
Right.
Okay, you borrowed it from somebody else to sell it before you own it. And now the price is going up. And you're like, wait a second. I sold it high, and now it's gone higher. So I'm going to have to buy it back at a higher price than I sold it for. So I'm going to lose money because the price is going up. because shorting is opposite land. And the bank comes along and more or less says, you know, you don't have enough money in the account because this the position you took is shrinking in value.
Right.
So you got to come up with more money. And they go, uh-oh, now we have to buy back the position so we stop losing money. But what did we just do?
Drive the price up even higher. Because
why?
Because the volume's higher. You're buying it, and so the supply and demand for
yeah, so
this,
which and which
this,
part of the curve? He's there. I'm just yeah, making him yeah. just making him use the right words for our listeners. So it's not a volume thing. Volume's how much of it's transacting.
Right, but the volume would go up if they're having to buy it in mass quantities
right.
in order to.
It's the demand side of the right. equation, yeah. right? So there's the supply of shares hasn't changed. But the number of people willing to buy it, or at this point required to buy it, right, drives the price higher. It's something called a short squeeze. Mm-hmm. We talked about this several months ago.
Wasn't
on
it
the
with
show.
GameStop?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly what we talked about. So this is sort of a short squeeze that then fueled oil. And it what it did was it just precipitated a conversation about the markets at large and how much the stock market has already gone up for the year. Whether or not there was any more gas in the tank for the last quarter. And we were looking at lots of different things. And then we started talking about the major things that move the market. Now, there are two things that I watch a lot and a third thing I'm starting to watch, and it had never been named before. And I don't think this is an official name either, but we kind of called it with air quotes, flow.
Flow.
Right? So fundamental stuff is, you know, all the different economic or financial data that you can get. So how much money does the company earn? How much debt does it have on the balance sheet? Where are the office locations? I mean, these are all fundamental pieces of information.
Right.
Okay. Then you have technical or quantitative data, and that's the price and the volume. How many people are buying it? When did they buy it? At what price did they buy it? Were the prices going higher or lower? Mm-hmm. And so you're studying price and volume. And then what I do is I marry the two together and say, well, when these events occur technically, what was going on in the fundamental landscape? And does that explain part of the story, right? Does it confirm something? Does it make sense? Like, oh, hey, we got the GameStop story. Wait a second. Why is this short squeeze happening? Well, they shorted more shares. They shorted more shares than even existed.
Right.
And you went, well, there's your problem. But That's part of it, is trying to marry the two up and see if they make sense. But the third one is new, right? And it's not that it's new, but we talk a little bit about this in our investment committee meetings, you guys. We talk about like how computers watch stuff.
Right.
Right. Okay. So
computerized trading.
Computerized trading, algorithmic trading. So and also how hedge funds behave or how market makers behave. Right. And so anybody want to tackle market makers for our listeners?
That produces the assets that are being sold.
The people just buying and selling the stocks
so
at the best available price.
So it's actually the brokerage itself. Like some companies have their
the
own inventory. Right?
Right.
So what they're saying is, hey, OK, so Justin and Matt want to buy these stocks, but you're going to go through me because I've got a pool
right.
of stocks sitting around. So by the time, Justin, we got to get it from your pocket to Matt's pocket. So, well, you just give me the shares of when you in the next day or two. Meanwhile, Matt, you get the shares from me today. You owe me, Justin, right?
Right.
I'm the market maker, so I'm going to facilitate this trade right now. And then we're going to get a couple days for that stuff to settle up in the marketplace. But that's how the market maker does that. And the beauty is me, I have my own inventory.
Right.
Right? Meaning, it's like I've got the car lot, and you guys, you know, you want to buy Justin, you want to buy a car for Matt, then I'll give you the same car that Matt's selling, kind of deal. Well, because I have my own inventory,
right?
That's what it would come down to. So it works like that with stocks, but my own inventory at a price. It's most relevant, I think. This is probably not most relevant, but it's very relevant in the options landscape. Mm-hmm. Right, that's the derivative marketplace, because these large market makers, they're the ones that actually create derivative instruments and then market them. So they got a real vested interest in how the market performs, because if you're writing an insurance contract, you don't want to get it actuarially wrong and cost you.
Right.
So the flow is all about the behavior of the marketplace and where things are going. And keep in mind that me, if I'm the order maker, I can see what you're doing, right? I can see both of you what you're willing to buy or sell.
Right.
That gives me a little bit of insight into what the market's doing. So the flow, to me, is an important element of, well, what are, for example, really large institutional blocks of money doing, right? Are they accumulating or distributing from some places? So now you've, and that should show up a little bit in the technical data, but it doesn't always because of one gotcha. We never really talk about this on the show, so you guys, I wouldn't expect you to know this, right? This is where I cheat because I got 20 years of doing this. So we've talked about the IPOs, right?
Right.
Okay.
So I'm just going to set our listeners up. The IPO deal, mostly because of the most recent one, our local little darling, right?
Dutch Bros. Right.
Exactly. So Dutch Bros has an IPO. People are saying, how do I get in? How do I get in? I said, you had to know somebody a while ago. And then you could go buy Dutch Brothers now because it's not an IPO. It's trading on the
secondary market.
Secondary market. But there's another market we don't talk about, right? The tertiary market or the institutional market, where there is no intermediary. Large mega conglomerate, when a large mega shareholder directly trades with another shareholder, right? So maybe mutual funds do a swap directly in between. They don't go through an exchange per se. They just do a direct trade. It'd be the equivalent of Justin and Matt say, we don't need to use you, David. Matt walks over to Justin's house with the shares and signs them over.
Right. So those would be exempt transactions.
So they're exempt, I think, has a different meaning in regulatory terms. Okay. They're not exempt. They are not facilitated through an exchange. So you don't necessarily see these giant, because they're typically done after hours. Right. So they're not going to happen during the day. So
do those volumes get recorded?
So not on the secondary market because they don't trade on the secondary market.
Gotcha.
Now, some of it will, right? Like if you see, for example, the S&P 500 kicks a stock off and adds a new one on, that's going to show up all over the place because there's a bunch of mutual funds and retail things that mimic indexes. So it's going to get caught up in the froth of the trades there. But if mutual fund company A wants to trade with mutual fund company B and they want to do a direct transfer, they don't have to go through a third-party intermediary to get that done. They can do direct
transactions. Does it get registered as a sale?
It's, yes.
Hmm. Okay.
But it's not on the secondary market. So
yeah.
I know why you're asking the question, but it's not going to show up there.
Gotcha.
Right? It's not going to be, it may move the market, but that supply and demand isn't playing in the same pools, right? So it doesn't mean that it doesn't affect things, but it's not going to, it's going to be sort of out
behind
on
the
fringe.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, that whole story is a lot of the flow part of it, right?
Okay.
It's the stuff that you don't always see those elements of what are the market makers doing? What are institutional blocks doing? What are hedge funds doing? And that's, you know, where they sort of start the popularity contest. Because, you know, you and me, you know, we go out there and throw a few bucks in the market. You've got your 401k plan or something. And what does that mean? I mean, you could buy $1 million worth of Microsoft and it's trading, what, how many hundreds of millions of dollars per day? Right.
Nobody even notices.
Yeah. You're a rounding error.
Right.
Right. The market doesn't notice that. It has to get pretty big or the positions have to be pretty thinly traded to move them. Right. So you go buy a penny stock, you could mess it all up.
Right.
But anyway, so that's the three things I thought it'd be kind of fun to talk about, is especially in light of what's going on in the market right now, right? I mean, because I don't know if you guys checked, but last week was kind of rough, and Monday wasn't exactly grand. Then today, not so bad. So what's that all about? It's about what we talk about after this insane profit break. Exactly. So we'll do that. Are they playing the music? You got the headphones.
Yep.
All right, they are. So we'll take it to break and we'll be right back. Stick around, gang. This is Dave Littlejohn.
Justin Bruggeman.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Thank you.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang. Welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with two of my favorite advisors in town, Mr.
Matt Dixon
and
Justin Brugman.
So we do, and then I have to point at them and see how quick the response time is. You guys are kicking tail. And if you guys can't tell, all of our listeners, I am wired. So I'm now standing in the studio because that or I pass out. Is that how that works?
Did you drink too much Dutch Bros, David? Is that it? You're too caffeinated? You're ready to go?
No, I didn't even do that.
Jeez.
I just have actual calories.
It's from sitting on the plane and then sitting in the car. And you got to get up and move.
You were bunched up for too long. You're ready to go.
It's true. I didn't get a direct connect from Dallas this morning. So I had to go through Denver. And yeah, I just got to where I'm like, all right, I'm tired of sitting. It's been like six and a half hours of sitting.
Mm.
Just going, I'm going to need to, I don't even like running, but there's this part of me that says, but you might need to move. And then I look outside and go, what do you guys do to the weather?
It's nasty out there.
My well's full now, so that's good.
Okay. Yeah, inside story there, gang. Well, look, if you are just tuning in, there is podcast. You can get the setup to the show. But here's the thing we're exploring a little bit today. This is more like a backdrop for trying to get an understanding of how the markets operate. You know, these markets, they go up, they go down. And a lot of people take this attitude of like, yeah, whatever, it's long term, so I don't care. And then some people look at this and they just stress over it going, oh, my gosh, what's going to happen next? It's, you know, the end of the world. And then some of you are thinking it's because the other team did this thing. Right. And so we all get our way of working into a lather about it. And then I have been having conversations with a whole bunch of financial pros, and we just shrug our shoulders and go, well, it just sort of does this stuff. Right. After more than two decades of watching this, my level of panic continues to drop because yesterday sucked. It's a technical term. And then today, big bounce.
Right.
And it wasn't even that surprising. Right. I mean, it was a sort of an oversold technical rally, mostly in big tech.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And what we'll probably see, and this is not a prediction, don't go trade off of this, but, you know, we may see another day or two of rebound. And then we'll probably see another knockdown too, because what the market seems to be looking for is the 200-day moving average. And the reason I'm sharing these numbers with you is not to impress you, because it's absolutely relevant to the conversation about fundamental data, flow, and technical analysis, right? So as the newest guy here, Matt.
Oh, man. Hot seat time.
Yeah, hot seat time.
Justin back.
What do you know? So, I mean, of the three between flow, fundamental, and technical, which one, I'm going to let you pick which one you're going to help our listeners figure out first. We're going to kind of break them down and describe just some basics.
Let's go with fundamental.
All right.
So with fundamental analysis, we're looking at the books and we're saying, okay, we're not really like looking at the technical stock charts. We're not looking at the movement as much.
So it's not really charting.
Yeah, we're not
point.
Charting. We're looking more at like price to earnings. Of a company, we're looking at, are they meeting earnings? Are they
kind of balance
profitable?
Sheet.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So what's their income statement look like? How are they doing as a company? Not just what is the chart showing us?
Right. So that'll be the stuff that is mostly the things that are going to be reporting, right? So when the company publishes data, that's the fundamental stuff. Hey, here's our estimated earnings or our forward guidance. All that stuff falls under the category of fundamental,
right?
Because companies providing that information to the public. Okay, so Justin, you want to go with flow or technical?
I'm gonna go with technical because I'm
you
still
do it
a little,
all the time.
I'm still a little borderline with this flow.
Yeah, when I hear flow, all I think is the Progressive commercials. So I'm tapping right. out on that.
That's literally what it is. So,
and so even more on the technical side is what you know we're kind of looking at. You talked about the 200-day moving average, which is just the average price in the last 200 days.
Right.
And then the 100-day, then the 50. And we look at also a lot of what we their Bollinger Bands, which is just the standard deviation or the price movement up and down in a stock. And whether if it falls outside of that normal standard deviation, those are quotes,
Yeah.
We could see air quotes on the radio.
Could be considered oversold or overbought, which could be points to either buy or sell or reposition.
Yeah. So more like trading conditions.
Correct.
Okay, so you know the fundamental data is the stuff the company's publishing. The trading conditions are really the
what's actually happening.
Yeah, sort of. It's actually looking at what it is doing behavior wise, price and behavior wise. How many people are buying it and when, and then we talk about marrying those data points up. Hey, we saw a spike in volume right before they're going to post a dividend.
Right.
Oh, okay. Well, then everybody thought they wanted to go front run a dividend. So. Now we talk about flow, right? Flow is the ambiguous stuff. It's really the institutional behavior, though. What is institutionally occurring where money is moving around? Okay, so this is a lot harder for the consumer level or the retail side of the marketplace to really get information on this. For example, fund flows. Okay, how many people are buying or selling mutual funds, and in what categories?
Right.
That's harder data to access. It's not like they just throw it up on the screen somewhere and everybody sees it. Or the stocks that hedge funds are buying or selling and when, right? What kind of positional behavior are institutions taking? Or what are the trading desks for market makers doing? If you don't know what I mean by market makers, check out the podcast. It was in the last segment. Okay. And then there's a fourth category of analysis that we also can't do, and you guys aren't going to guess this one, right? It's cheating.
Guess.
Yeah, cheating, right? Inside information.
Right.
It's not legal, right? And when you catch people on it, the most recent, this was a funny one last week, is people are saying we need to audit the Federal Reserve because it looks like maybe there's some people that are, conspicuous trading and they're policymakers. And everybody in the office all of a sudden went, audit Congress. really, how remarkable that you would quickly jump on, let's audit somebody else, but, you'd whistle right past that graveyard yourself.
Didn't Martha Stewart get popped for that some years back?
She did for insider trading. Yeah. Yeah, and the representative did more time than she did on it, but she actually had some jail time over it. And meanwhile, I think we could argue probably with very suspicious evidence, right? It's still, I don't have any, aha Scooby-Doo mask relief moment here, but I do have a lot of indicating data here that says there's some people in Congress that sure have had really good trades that are really well-timed. I mean, and they're really savvy. And in all of their spare time while representing the public, they just made these remarkable financial calls, too.
And yeah, I've been watching that a little bit.
You guys are just really in tune there. So I'm not suspicious at all, wink, nudge. but cheating, we don't count, right? Plus, I don't have access to it. I don't know where the inside information would come from. So I guess it's okay. It makes cheating harder when you can't cheat.
You got to know someone that knows someone.
Yeah. Well, and people make stuff up all the time, I'm sure. But the reason we're having this conversation is not about the cheating or anything else. I loved this description I heard over the last week about they described the market as the plumbing. Right. These three things are the plumbing of the market. How does this stuff flush around in there? Where's it moving? How's it connected? Because it gives you a sense of why the market moves like it does. I mean, up and down is normal, right? I mean, it's normal. So if you're getting uncomfortable with a move, say yesterday, going, oh my gosh, do you realize that the S&P 500 is up still? I mean, what are we at year to date? Like 14 or 13?
After yesterday, I think about 15.
So 15. Ish, we're like less than 5% from all time highs.
Well, wasn't it when didn't we look at it? Which maybe I'm wasn't like 48% of the stocks is in the S&P 500 under their 200-day moving average?
Yep.
Like last week.
Yep.
Wow.
Now that's, which is amazing.
That's a technical stat, by the way. Right. I guess it's a. Yeah, it walks a funny talk, but it's a technical stat. Can you explain to our listeners what that means, though?
Well, yeah, it just means that of what? So half of the stocks in the S&P 500, so 250, below the average price in their last 200 trading days.
Yeah,
and so that would usually mean that the price of the S&P 500 would push down a little.
Yeah,
bit.
Yeah, you'd expect the whole thing to be lower.
Right.
Right, because if half the stocks are below the price that they've been averaging for the last 200 days.
How are they possible?
Then you're like, well, why is the index up 15%? Right. Half the stocks are below.
And wasn't it mainly tech that took the brunt force of that?
Well, so tech is what got beat up. But you're sneaking around at the whole issue in the first place, right? That were 50% of those, the stocks below 200-day moving average, how many were tech stocks?
Right. And what's the weighting
That'd
of those 250 stocks?
That'd be an interesting statistic.
Yeah. Well, and the answer is probably next to nothing.
Right.
Right? Because as a weighting for the S&P 500 now, I think the top 10 stocks make up about a third of the weighting of the whole thing.
I think six make up 28% or something like that.
That's nuts.
It is. And it's because the biggest stocks also continue to get the most new money thrown at them as people invest in indexes.
Right.
Right. If you're buying an index fund right now, then you're disproportionately buying tech within the index. Mm-hmm. And that means that they are continuing to get more order flow or more demand for more shares, which helps bolster their price.
Right.
So super mega large companies get super mega larger as part of the regular event of these indexes being invested into. Right. And indexing has become massive, mm-hmm. right? Absolutely massive. Now, it works great until it doesn't, right? I mean, there are some mechanical challenges to indexing too, because of that very point you just made. That means that half the stocks of the S&P 500 are actually going down.
Right.
So it means that 6 to 10 stocks, if they go up, they kind of hide all the other activity underneath, right? I love using the term, you guys have all heard it on the airport. This is an eclipse, right? You can't see the sun because the moon's in the way. All right, well, I see the moon. That's all I know. Well, the sun is lots bigger, but it's hidden from your perspective. And that's kind of how it works for us as investors, is if, 10 stocks cover up the other 490, all you need is those 10 stocks to go up. If the rest of them go down, maybe it looks like nothing happened at all.
Right.
Now, if you don't own the S&P 500, now you have to pick your stocks more carefully.
Right.
Yeah. So that one is a fun and interesting animal, but I think it's really important to understand the plumbing of this market too. It's also why when people ask, hey, do we have another 2008 coming? And I scratch my head a little bit and say, well, I don't know that this is the same as 2008. You know why?
Well, one, they've put different regulations in place
yeah.
to avoid that.
That's part of it. And two,
you're going to tell them after the break.
All right, we'll tell you after. There was more, but we'll just wait. Stick around. If you want to know why I don't think it's 2008, Justin and Matt are going to tell you. But we got to take an obscene profit break first. Stick around. This is Dave Littlejohn.
Justin Bruggeman.
And Matt Dixon.
You got True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. I've got my gang together here. Welcome to the studio. Thanks, Justin and Matt.
It's the dream team.
Yes, and thanks for holding down the fort while I was gone. Right, good work.
We tried. It's still there.
Still there. That's always a good thing. And now it's do we build an ark? I mean, we've had a drought, and now we're going to just let it rip.
I enjoy rain now.
I missed it. I actually don't mind the rain as much as if there's one thing, right? Not that there's nothing I can do about this. It's just that the days get short here. As I get older, the snowbird thing makes more and more sense, to which I then have to explain to people. If there's one thing that COVID did that was an awesome favor for me personally, It didn't do any other favors than this that I can conjure up right now, other than maybe, you know, some intentional time with my family. We're all burnt out on Zoom, but we all know how to use it now.
Right.
That's true.
We've had our business built to be completely virtual and in the cloud since 2010. And when this came along, it was like, how are we going to do it? And we're like, well, you're just going to take your computer home, I guess. And it was seamless.
It was even better because you had been talking about it about a year before that. Like, we need to get this in place. And we kind of just shrugged our shoulders and went, and then COVID happened. You're like, well, we're going to have to now.
Well, but it was already there.
Yeah.
Right?
It was there.
Everybody's just like, I don't want to deal with it. Rah, 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 rah. It's okay. I don't even have to say I told you so. You guys did.
Right.
So anyway, look, today's talk, we're getting into the plumbing of the markets. And right before the last break, if you missed it, I'm going to give you this one little opportunity to catch up. Otherwise, grab our podcast because there's more. If you want to get an understanding of how this fits together, there's more. Go to littlejohnfs.com, and under the What We're About tab, there's three things: educate, plan, and invest. This show, part of the educate, right? We're going to teach when we can. We're not selling a whole lot today other than our charm and disposition.
I'll figure out a way to sell it at the end, though, David. Just give me a chance.
You still have to remember the phone number, Matt.
541-something.
That's the way to narrow that down. And you call yourself a numbers guy? Come on, man. We're going to get that tattooed on you. So anyhow, under that Educate tab, there'll be a podcast. You can check this out. And if you are so inclined or you take value out of it, share it with a friend. That's how the word gets around, right? But the plumbing of the market, and at the break, we said, hey, you know what's different this time around compared to 2008? Right? Because guys my age or a little older, few of you younger, there were some younger folks that were taking this one on the chin, but this was a prime time for me and my family. We were just launching. We just bought a house just in time to have, oh, we're going to sell this in 2 years. 12 years later, when we sell it for what we bought it for, it was licking our wounds and moving forward with life. So 2008 punched some people in the face. Real estate collapse. Stock market fell by 50%. The Great Recession, as they called it. Bunch of job losses. Bunch of bank failures. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, like, we don't have nearly as many banks as we did 15 years ago. So what is different today than in the crash of 2008?
Which, and I said before the break, the different regulations they've put in place for bad lending.
Yeah. Although, interestingly enough, we are seeing an escalation in it's getting easier to borrow money.
Right.
Right? I mean, we're seeing the standards for lending in the residential marketplace have been relatively manageable.
Right.
Right. They're not completely no documentation. We haven't gone to full crazy yet. Right.
Yeah.
But it's a lot easier.
Keyword.
And we've seen, this was an interesting thing too recently. What did we also see in the mortgage marketplace? We saw an increase in the conforming loan limits. Right.
Okay.
So they actually bumped up the amount that you can get for a normal conforming loan, and I don't know what it was. But
was it a percentage-based deal off of income?
No. It used to be something like, you know, it used to be like $425,000 was the most you could get with a conventional loan, and now it's up to like $500,000+. So conventional loans, and if non-conventional means you're getting into jumbo loans, right? So they're above a certain size, and then jumbo loans have different standards of qualifying.
So the loans are easier to get and they're higher amounts.
So yes, largely. Or they're not harder to get, at least, and they're larger amounts. So you can borrow more money to get a house. And the crazy thing today is, I thought we got a good deal when we got a mortgage at 6%. Today people would look at that and say, "Oh my gosh, your mortgage is 6%?
Right.
What did you get your first credit card at the same time?" You know.
What year was that? 6% being a good rate.
That was December of 2005.
Wow.
Yeah, and then we got to refi one time with some program that got us down to 4.85, but then we couldn't do it again because there was no equity in the house and the program was spent. And then, you know, rates continued to plummet. Yeah, that house was never an investment, other than we started our family there and it kept the rain off our heads, and so it worked well for us. But we'd have probably been in a different spot financially had we just rented. We'd had more money left over just renting.
Wow.
Yes, that's not typically how that goes, by the way.
Not anymore. The way rent prices have gone through the roof.
Now, but see, this is all relevant to what was going on with the backdrop of the banking system, right? And like, why is today different? Because the question is, how are we different today? And you said the regulatory environment, right?
Right.
Okay. So there's another really significant difference. Okay? Bank balance sheets don't look that bad.
Right.
Right. Now, maybe you don't know what that means. I realize a lot of our listeners are probably going, huh?
Because just amount of debt that they were carrying?
Well, it's the amount of collateral compared to what they are lending out, right? Remember, banks have a fractional reserve requirement. So the reserve means that for all the money that they loan out, they have a certain amount in reserves at the same time. Well, they also need to have collateral for those reserves. And their balance sheets, they've got enough assets in reserve right now.
Did they raise the reserve limit since 2008?
I don't know. Is the short answer to that. It can shift around, but they haven't necessarily done a lot of shifting of reserve requirements to my knowledge. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could talk to, maybe we've got some mortgage pros out there, and maybe we'll look at bringing a guest on the show in the near future to have that discussion. But usually it's reserve requirements or interest rates, right? So the interbank lending rate, they can jockey around and so forth. But yeah, if you think about all of those circumstances, that wasn't it. So, I mean, the banks they seem to be well capitalized. Okay. The other is the default rates are very low. And this all contributes to the same darn thing. Matt, was it easy to evict people in the last year?
No, it was not.
But if you didn't pay your loan, did they foreclose on landlords?
They did not. There was some forgiveness there.
Right. So what happened is the risk in the marketplace wasn't borne necessarily by the banks.
But someone's got to carry that burden.
Well, if you don't make your loan payments, right, it gets tacked onto the end, right, and you still get to pay more interest.
The interest doesn't magically grow too.
Yeah. So it's not like you got away with it.
So we're just,
the landlords are getting hosed, right? Mm-hmm. And the banks are getting hosed.
We just haven't had to deal with the fallout.
The people that are renting aren't getting hosed, right? Now, I don't want to get into the politics of it or anything else, but I could just tell you from an economic standpoint, when you allow one party to break the rules of a contract, you do create a problem, right? Because now all of a sudden contracts don't mean as much. If you say, oh, you have an obligation to pay rent, and if you don't do it, you have to go, and then the government comes in and goes, and a second thought, all contracts that you agreed to are no longer in play. In fact, we're going to just kind of rewrite the rules as it best suits us to keep getting reelected. And you go, oh my, we no longer have contract law that we can rely upon? Scary. But are the banks going to collapse?
No.
Probably not. Because guess where all of the bad obligations have run off to?
The federal government.
The Federal Reserve. Not even the federal government. Federal Reserve has just said, oh, well, the federal government has printed treasuries. We will simply buy those and hold them on our balance sheet. How did you pay for those? Oh, yeah, with money we printed. Wait, what? Like, yep, nope, didn't have to give it to the banks. They didn't have to worry about it. Didn't have to give it to consumers. We just printed the money and put it on. It's not even in a vault, right?
We
just changed the numbers on our spreadsheet, and we're like, all right, well, spreadsheet looks fine. That doesn't even weigh more than it did last time.
That just sounds like delayed inflation to me.
It's all kinds of, it's called modern monetary theory, right? So this is probably last. Do we have to take one last break?
I think we do.
I guess we do. So hang out and we'll just fill in the little details of modern monetary theory and why you care. Because it's that last bridge of the plumbing from the markets to D.C., those wacky guys and gals. All right, we got to take it. We'll be right back. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Justin Brogman.
Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the home stretch of the True Wealth Radio Show. Oh, no, you're on the hot seat now, guys. You got to check the podcast to get caught up. We're talking about market plumbing today. How does all this stuff connect? And at the break, we left our heroes with this cliffhanger of a question. What is modern monetary theory? And Matt, you started to give me the definition of monetary policy during the break, okay? Which is how the Federal Reserve changes the supply of money in circulation.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the other would be fiscal policy, which is
the government mandating regulations that change the flow of money.
Right. So how the government impacts it, changing tax rates and so forth. So what's the basic definition as I you better remember this. I gave it to you like 5 seconds ago, right? Which is what is modern monetary theory in a nutshell?
I mean, it's basically the government being able to print money when it needs to bail itself out in really basic terms.
Yeah, and even more basic, I'll take a step back from that. It's the idea that the federal debt isn't really relevant. It just means that there's a spreadsheet for the money, and because we're the ones with the printing press, we can manipulate the variables to smooth out the needs of the economy, if you will, right? So we'll just go ahead and stabilize the economy through manipulating the entire monetary system. And so the debt isn't really that big of a deal. Now, just so we're clear, this is a theory, it's relatively new, and it is not agreed upon. So I'm gonna ask the tricky question, and I wanna see which of you guys is brave here. If the government borrows money from somebody, but then has the printing press to decide what it's going to pay them back with, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, would it, the value of the dollar is dependent on how much they print.
Right. I mean, certainly that.
Change it.
It means that the government's faith and credit is really on the hot seat.
Right. It's in their own control, basically.
Well,
they control
it
everything.
They always have. Fiat currencies work like this, right? But when you are the global reserve currency and you've got other countries and your own citizenry and everybody's lending money in the form of purchasing your treasury bonds, and you start to manipulate the value of all the currencies and your economic system, what it means to me is tread carefully, because if you lose the trust of the lender, because remember, you're the borrower. If you lose the trust of the lender, you have a real problem. You know, so what they can do is, yeah, you could pull the thread a little bit, but if you get a snag, I mean, you can unravel the sweater in a hurry. You don't want to lose the faith and credit in your fiat currency. Then all of a sudden you're Nigeria or Venezuela, right? Your currency doesn't mean anything. Nobody will trust it any longer. So you, while in theory you can pull the lever and do whatever you want, in practice you can only go so far as everybody else will allow it before they lose confidence in your currency. Now, if you have a military, it helps, because you can kind of point a gun at people and say, you will trust our currency, right?
Have we seen that recently?
Kind of. Because it may not be your own citizens. It may be the rest of the world saying, no, you can't have your own guns. We have them. And by the way, you're going to use our currency. Right? That's kind of how it works when you're in these big political gatherings. And it's like, well, we're the world police. We can. Now, I'm not even saying that's good, bad, or otherwise, because I think that the United States has been remarkably benevolent. And I think there are some people out there that can fairly rationalize, hey, we give a bunch of foreign aid out there. If we need to move the dollar values around a little bit so that we're not starving people in other countries, you guys will get over it, right?
Okay.
I can understand where they're coming from. Not saying it's okay, but I'm saying that's what we're dealing with right now. The reason I'm not worried so much about 2008, this is the trick as we go into the end of the show, everybody's doing it. Right, all like the G20, they're all in on it. They're all doing it. So, yeah, I don't think it's 2008. I think we could have a shakeup, but we'll see if and when it comes, right? So anyway, we're out of time for today. I know we didn't talk about financial planning at all, but hopefully you got a better shot at understanding the plumbing of this market and why the up and down is normal and why we care about our politicians. If you want to dig deeper, give our office a call. Matt, have you figured out the number yet?
I'm going to take a stab at it, and it's probably going to be wrong.
Better hurry.
541-375-0898.
Oh. All right, gang, until next time, this has been Dave Littlejohn.
And Justin Brueggemann.
Matt Dixon.
You're listening to True Wealth.